Hello and welcome to the Open Talent Report. This is the podcast where we discuss the emerging trends in labor law, employment law, independent work, and the gig economy, which many organizations are wrestling with due to the growth of the open talent and gig economy. I'm your host, Conor Heaney. When I'm not presenting the podcast, I'm the MD at CXC Global, EMEA, which compliantly connects talent and opportunity. Hello and welcome to this week's show, where my guest is author, and I can say that now, Anita, you're an author, speaker, and partner at the Strategic Management Center. I'm very pleased to welcome Anita Letting. Prior to this part of her career, or this iteration of her career, Anita was a senior executive at Northgate Arinzo, now Alight. So, Anita, this is our second time having you on the show, and a very warm welcome to you. How are you doing today?
Hi, Connor. Thanks for inviting me back, and I'm doing very well.
Well, that's great to hear, Anita. So I think we did a good job last time. You came back anyway for seconds, and we're delighted to have you back on the show. So, Anita, as I mentioned in the introduction, you're now an author. I think that's official. If you were previously and I didn't pick that up, then you know I'll take a metaphorical slap on the hands. But you've recently written a book called How to Select Your Payroll, The Ultimate Guide. So I guess my first question, Anita, is why did you decide to write your book?
So I decided to write my book, Connor, because especially this year, I noticed a lot of articles in the news about payroll go-lives going wrong. And that's a problem because, look, when you do a new system implementation, there's always a risk. But when you do a new implementation of a payroll, you run the potential risk of touching everyone in the company. Mm. And when payroll goes wrong, I don't have to tell you that you're looking at a lot of not only disgruntled employees, but even worse, people who cannot pay the bills. And so I decided to write my first book. It was indeed my first book, where I share what I have learned during, you know, or from 20 years of running payroll projects for large clients, helping people move from one payroll to another, and then also helping companies decide what payroll solution to buy to replace the solution they currently have.
Love it, Anita. And Anita, it's the first book I've come across that really goes into significant detail in this space. And you're quite right. I always feel that in the HR and finance world that payroll is the neglected cousin, right? the one that you only see at family weddings every couple of years. You go, oh yeah, that's my cousin. They're pretty interesting. And really, Anita, I'd love to delve into some of the main topics that your book seeks to address. What are the main topics that you go pretty deep on?
So the first topic that I really describe in detail is the preparation. And that is not the preparation in the sense of we're going to select a new payroll, what kind of vendor should we choose, but actually the steps that you need to take internally to make sure that you are ready to go out and find these vendors. Think, for instance, about your data structures. Where is it? How can you find it? Is it just in one system? Is it in more systems? What data is historical data and can sit in those systems? What data needs to be migrated to the new systems? Something else that you need to think about is, for instance, payroll procedures, payroll policies. Now, from a procedures perspective, if you're moving from a solution to an outsourcing service, then the procedures aren't that interesting because your new vendor will provide those for you. But policies are extremely interesting. You need to tell the new provider what kind of payroll policies govern your employee payments. And if you just have salaried employments that or employees, that probably isn't very difficult. But if you are running payroll for a company that has been in existence for, let's say, 25 years, and you've done a number of mergers and acquisitions, then there is a reasonable chance that you have company employees on still on payment policies from those companies simply because you have to take them with you when you add those people to your payroll. And who's to say that those policies have been described in detail? The payroll administrators that created those policies have probably already left the company. So it's the legacy that you really have to worry about and that you have to understand in detail before you move to a new solution. And then one of the things that I just mentioned is that you also have to worry about the future. For instance, are you going to grow? Are you going to expand the firm through mergers and acquisitions? Before you choose a new payroll vendor, there's a couple of things that you need to decide on from a services perspective, right? Do you think that you will still be able to employ your own payroll administrators? Or because of the labor shortage, will you not be able to find those people? And is it therefore more advantageous to now make the decision to also outsource the services?
Yes.
So there's this whole load of issues that you need to address one by one, investigate, make a decision before you can actually start to run your payroll selection process. And I think many companies overlook that. And that means that then the payroll vendor drives that process instead of the payroll buyer. And that is never good.
Anita, if it's okay, I might put a sort of hypothetical use case to you. So let's say you're a big pharma company A, and you've got, let's say, 58 global entities around the globe, and you're on different payroll providers or technology vendors, and you're thinking, right, I'm going to consolidate this into one specific vendor. Suppose my first question is, right, is there a global vendor out there or global vendors that can manage multi-country payrolls that can provide the same level of service with the same technology overlay in the United States as they can in Australia or Japan or Brazil or UK? Because payroll on the face of it seems quite simple, right? Everyone needs paid. They're full-time employees. They work a certain amount of hours. They get X amount of holidays statutorily. There's X, Y, Z bank holidays or public holidays, right? That can all be programmed and baked into the cake, I guess. But is it as simple as that or is it much more complex?
Well, there's two sides to this question, Connor. So the first one is, are there companies that can run this for you? 58 countries for my industry example. Yes, there are. The second part of the question is where it actually gets more interesting.
Yes.
And that is, would these companies or would these vendors be able to run that for you on a single engine, on a single platform?
Yes.
Probably not.
Mm.
So that totally depends on the makeup of your company and the countries that we are talking about. And it goes beyond the scope of this conversation to say what would and what would not work, because we would have to examine 180 countries. But it is, I would say the following. I like to be very practical.
Yes.
It is really about the problems that you're trying to address. For instance, if these 58 countries run a good payroll and it's compliant and you're happy with it, and there's really no need to move other than I want to understand the data that's behind this and I want to run reports and analytics on top of the results of these 58 countries, then I would say leave the payroll engines where they are. You're happy with the services. Don't go through the headache of a major payroll upgrade. Instead, there are now companies that will sell you a sort of overlay system where you can upload the end result of all these payrolls, and they run reporting and analytics through those through that solution, and it works perfectly. Now, the answer changes if you, for instance, have a couple of countries where the payroll engine is end of life, because then it might be advantageous to think about moving all your payrolls to the cloud, for instance, and benefit from all the new technologies and the new features that come with that.
Anita, I'd like to look at the future of payroll, but maybe before we do that, if you look at the technology landscape that supports payroll, both regionally, locally, or globally, what, if anything, are you seeing that's interested in the payroll technology space?
I think what we have seen, especially during the pandemic, is the rise of these global workforce solutions that will help you take care of pay and compensation in many countries around the world. And the reason that they can do that, of course, is because systems now often use APIs where they can easily exchange data and send it back and forth. And so the fact that more technologies have now standardized on APIs, I think, is a major upgrade in the sense that we can better manage what's going on and better understand what's going on at the country level or even at a business unit or department level, and have more insights. There are also a number of companies that are now offering payroll as an API or payroll as a solution in a back office that you can integrate with. And that means that more cloud ERP solutions are being developed that use one of those payroll engines to offer a full suite of services to companies. And those solutions are typically focused on the, I would say, the SMB space. And this has been a space that is really underserved from a payroll perspective, but also from other solutions, from an ERP perspective. And I think that is a space that is really in development, and where you also see a lot of industry specific or branch specific solutions now come to market.
Mm. And Anita, earlier in our discussion, you mentioned around payroll engines. Has anyone successfully created a global payroll engine that covers all the major markets in some of the smaller countries, or even 180 countries plus?
To my knowledge, there isn't one.
What? Yes. No one's that insane.
No. Or maybe it's the best kept secret ever. I think where in the past you saw that companies would come to market with the request for a global payroll solution, they have now realized that is next to impossible. And these global payroll requests are often broken up in regional payroll requests, because there are several companies in the market that can satisfy the request from a regional perspective, right? They cover all countries in Europe on one engine, or they cover a substantial amount of countries in Asia or in Africa on one engine. So I really think that these regional engines are the way forward, and it will be very difficult for one vendor to manage all countries in the world on a single payroll engine. I don't even think it's necessary.
Interesting. And Anita, as we look to the future and specifically the future of payroll, where do you see it going? What's your take on it?
One of the things that I see more attention for is the amount of data that sits inside of payroll and therefore the insights that could be produced by payroll. And I have written about fintech companies in the past and also their interest in payroll data. And slowly but surely, you see payroll and fintech moving closer together. There are a couple of fintech companies that are adding payroll engines. One of the internet banks has now included a small and simple payroll engine, but it is a payroll engine. And because these fintech companies are all based on new technologies and on cloud, and they don't have any legacies, it's fairly easy for them to establish connections to modern payroll systems and use that payroll data. Now, there is a privacy element that we need to take into consideration because fintech companies do not want that data for nothing, right? their business model often is based on the fact that they can utilize that data and then sell insights or sell something else on top of that data or using that data. And think about, for instance, that they could do mortgage approvals by having constant access to payroll data. Obviously, companies need to approve that connection. And finally, employees also need to approve that connection. Do you really want a financial company to have access to all your financial data all the time? On the other hand, it might be very beneficial for employees to not have to worry about money in the sense that as soon as the payment is being made, your regular payments, your mortgage payment, your insurance payment, your car payment, is already taken out of your salary before it even hits the bank. And that might help some people manage their financial situation in the sense that they don't have to worry about it. And what ends up in their bank account is the money that they can spend during the month. And if you think about that, that could help alleviate some of the financial wellness issues that many people are struggling with. So there are some advantages, there are some disadvantages, and I think time will tell what takes precedence.
Yeah, I really like some of the ideas that you've put out there, Anita. The piece around financial well-being and financial health, and also the mortgage point that you mentioned, it would probably help a lot of decisioning around that, and also make it a much more efficient process. You know, if you think about applying for a mortgage, it's pretty much still paper based. You know, you need to get your pay slips for 6 months. You need to get your bank account statements for 6 months. You need all that sort of stuff. And it's typically paper based or PDF based. So I think it would make it a much more efficient process, subject to some of the privacy concerns and data protection issues that you mentioned being alleviated and so forth. But I really like where you're going with that, Anita. And Anita, you mentioned global workforce platforms, and I wanted to look at that, if that's okay with you. And specifically, I want to look at it from the prism of how they've been valued. And if I think of global workforce platforms and their emergence over the last, let's say, 2 years, I've been tracking about 28 of them, most of whom have raised at least $100 million US in funding. And I'm thinking of platforms and companies such as Let's Deal, remote Oyster HR Monday, skip app dev. The list goes on and on and on. But I guess my question really is, do you think the valuations that they were and have achieved are realistic? And do you think there might be some consolidation in that sector as recessionary headwinds start to bite?
So let me start to break apart that question, because that was a long question.
It was.
with a lot of aspects, right? First, the number of global workforce platforms. During the pandemic, we saw all these companies appear one after the other. Some existed prior to the pandemic, but a lot of them were established in 2020, 2021. And even this week, I saw one, I forgot the name, who got funded. I had never heard of them, but apparently they were founded last year. All of them offer an infrastructure to manage and pay people anywhere in the world. They focus obviously on compliance and security. And most of them work more or less along the lines of, they have a global overlay that they develop. They have working relationships or partnerships with in-country payroll partners or in-country financial partners who run these services for them. And they cater mostly to companies that have a small set of employees or contractors or independents in a country where these companies don't have a legal entity, or where they're simply too small to have their own payroll.
Yes.
This is a construct that works well when there's a lot of attention for remote workers. As soon as a company establishes a presence in a country and starts to employ people as official employees, when you go over, let's say, 10 to 20 employees, it makes more sense to switch to a salary provider. You could still use one of these global platforms to do that for you. But once you establish a local presence, there's all kinds of services that you need to that you need to buy. So you might as well use a or establish a payroll in that country. Now to your second question, the valuation of these companies. Valuation is a temporary thing, right? And it depends very much what type of valuation you choose. Many of these companies looked at SaaS valuations, and they could range anywhere from 4x to, I've also seen 10 or 11x. It doesn't really matter, because ultimately, well, what matters is how many customers do you have? What is your revenue, right? And I think especially these days, we're back to fundamentals. So investors are looking at revenues this month or this year instead of, well, they're also looking at projected revenues. What could you have over 5 years? But I think we're a little bit more back to normal, where it matters that you run a profit. And I think for the past five or maybe 10 years, it didn't matter so much if you would ever run a profit. Investors kept investing money in companies that have never made a profit so far. And there's more than a handful of examples of those companies. Yes. I think that one more sentence and then I'm done. So I don't think that valuation is a good number to look at. I know a couple of them were pronounced unicorns, but that is based on future earnings. And I think this year, what matters is this year's earnings and next year's earnings and what you have on the books in signed contracts.
Yeah, Anita, I agree with you. My own personal opinion is that phrases such as burn rate should be consigned to economic history, if they should even have such a place in economics, because it just strikes me as crazy that was an accepted way of building business at pretty much all costs. It sort of blows my mind that we have accepted that term for so long. But it strikes me that maybe investment and investor sentiment is maybe moving against that, at least temporarily, until free money might come back again or central banks start juicing up the pot. But anyway, I'll get off my soapbox, Anita, for the moment. But Anita, do you feel that there will be some consolidation in that global workforce platform space, given the amount of new entrants, given the possibility of at least the short-term recession in most major markets, and given that remote working, at least across borders, might not be here to stay? What's your take on the consolidation piece?
When you talk about consolidation in a sense that one of these global platforms will buy another,
yes,
I don't think so, just because it wouldn't help them. What I do think is that there are maybe a couple of more regional payroll companies that are looking at these global platforms as an extension of their services. That is more of a consolidation I would see happening than mergers within the global workforce platforms themselves.
Gotcha, Anita. And Anita, I, as you know, and some of our listeners will know, I'm always a big fan of your work, particularly your blog and your research piece. And I'm sure our listeners are sick to death of me referencing your amazing piece on the Great Resignation. But I always read your blogs with interest. And I've read one recently, I think, on blockchain and Web3. But what other interesting trends are you seeing out there in the world of work? And would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, I was writing that blockchain piece simply because before the summer, I had asked my readers, the readers of my newsletter, what I should write about. And this was one of the suggestions that came back. And since I last wrote about it in 2018, I was sort of curious about the progress myself. So if anyone wants to read that, then go to newsletter.anitaletting.com and look at it and let me know what you think. Also, of course, in light of everything that's going on with the metaverse and Web3, it is interesting to take a new look at what's happening in the HR and payroll space with blockchain. Currently, I'm doing a lot of work to understand the concepts behind Web3 and the metaverse, but more so Web3, and what they could potentially mean for work and therefore for HR. And some of that work will come to, or I will publish in, I would say, the November, December timeframe. So that might be interesting to follow. And then some of the things that I did in the summer was to really look at demographics again, because the United Nations released the latest population data. And you know that I always like to understand the data to see if workforce trends are actually factual or myths. And I found a super interesting article on the weekend, which I will publish a little piece about tomorrow, which is called An Obituary to Generations. And in the article, two researchers make the case for the fact that generations are actually not a scientific way to look at workforce output. In other words, there's no relation between generations and work habits. And so every article that starts with the headline, Millennials Are or Generation C Is, and then continue with something at work, are therefore nonsense. And I have always argued that because, you know, for instance, millennials, if you look at the definition of millennials and you look at the population data, that is 1.8 billion people. Oh. So how can the habits, the work habits of 1.8 billion people be exactly the same? And how can we therefore make declarations like millennials are such and such at work or millennials want this or that at work? Well, we're talking about 1.8 billion people. That is just, I mean, that's just nonsense.
Yes. Yeah, that is, I agree with you, Anita. And I mean, there's nothing better than challenging the received wisdom. That's why I love speaking with you, Anita. It always gives me a fresh take of things and probably confirms some of my own biases.
I think it's more that you see it in the news and everyone is repeating it, and at a certain point in time, you don't even notice anymore that there's something strange going on with these headlines, right? And for some reason, I read them and then nothing happens. And then at a certain point, I think, hey, wait, what? And then things start to click. And then I suddenly make this connection to the data. And then I want to find how many people actually are in this generation. And does it make any sense what we're saying? And typically when I look at the data, I find out that, no, it does not make any sense.
Well, I'm looking forward to that article. And Anita, let's look at another term that I've seen gaining traction in everything from the Financial Times to the Economist to being posted on LinkedIn ad nauseum, and it's something that's been referred to as quiet quitting, right? Mm-hmm. And it strikes me as one of those phrases like the Great Resignation that doesn't really mean very much and might not be borne out by the evidence, but I want to get your thoughts on it. Is this a new name for something that exists already, or is it something more radical based on what you're reading and hearing?
Yeah, from my perspective, quiet quitting is, I really don't know what it is, Connor, to be honest.
Yes, Anita.
All right. Because it's people who do the work, people who have decided that they are not the ones that want to go above and beyond. They're just here to do the work. And I think that's perfectly fine. I mean, that is what they signed up for. That is in their contract. You do this for us, and then we pay you this amount at the end of the month. Now, for some reason, or maybe not for some reason, but companies have always tried to instill in people that you should go above and beyond. And many people accepted that as a way to build their career and to move up the career ladder. And if that is what you want, that is totally fine, and that is still possible. But if you remember the famous bell curve in being used in performance appraisals, you also know that the standard distribution is you have like 5 uber performers, then you have 10 overperformers, and then you have like 60 to 70% in the middle that are on a 5-point scale, get a 3. They're good people. They do the work. And then at the bottom, you have the people that are not performing and that you want to put on a performance plan. But quiet quitting seems to be about these 60 to 70% people that are doing the work. And so that's the majority of our companies. And those are the people that, if we are honest, those are the people that keep the companies going and deliver services and products to the customers. That is not the 10% at the top of the pyramid, because these people are thinking about new programs and new services, and they are always one step beyond. So they, while they might talk to clients, they are not the one delivering the services today. And I find it really demeaning. And that's also why I was a little bit in arms about it. I find it demeaning to talk about the people that show up every day and do the work as quiet quitters, because they have not quit at all. They aren't quiet. They've just decided that they are going to do the work that they get paid for. And there's nothing wrong with that from my perspective.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think Anita, that's why the phrase frustrates me, if I'm perfectly blunt about it. And I guess that's why I take issue with it for all the reasons that you've outlined. And, you know, if the 10% want to use discretionary effort and sacrifice other elements of their life, well, then good luck to them. That's probably going to happen anyway. And for those at the 20% or the other 10% bottom, you know, they're probably going to leave anyway, either through design or otherwise. So what the hell are people talking about?
Well, we have this, Connor, I don't know if there's a phrase for it in English as well, but we have this thing in the Netherlands that we call cucumber time. And during cucumber time, there's really no news. So this is a time in the summer when everyone is on vacation and the cucumbers ripe. That's probably what the term comes from. And so there's always a topic or something that is being blown up out of proportion because nothing else grabs the attention. And I have a feeling that this whole quiet quitting thing is a little bit because Great Resignation went flat. Everyone started to understand that that really wasn't happening. Something completely different was going on. And so now we needed something else to focus our attention on in the workplace. Maybe that's the explanation. I don't know, but it doesn't make any sense. There's no data to back it up. But I do blame the internet a little bit for their social media, because there are these catchphrases, like this one that originated on TikTok, and then it blows up out of proportion and suddenly everyone is talking about it. But we never really defined what it was.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's called silly season in the UK and Ireland. So cucumber season, is that what it's called, Anita?
I'm gonna have to roll this.
Okay, that's good. That's an interesting one. I think I might get some laughs from my UK and Irish team if I can.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna give it a shot, Anita. So, Anita, a thought just occurred to me, and I wanted to ask you this, and it might seem a simple question, but it looks like we're heading towards recession territory in most markets, and some are saying it's short. I mean, I know there was a lot of debate in the USA whether they were truly in a recession or not, but it strikes me that that was more political grandstanding than the normal accepted test for recession, which is two consecutive quarters of negative growth, as I understand it. But I'm thinking about recession, labor shortage, full employment, right? So typically where there is a recession or a sustained recession, jobs eventually go, right? And they normally go en masse, mm-hmm. and then there's a rebound of sorts. And I would argue that we've probably been in the midst of a hiring super cycle, probably over about the last 10 years, right? But I guess where I'm going with this one, Anita, is do you feel that a recession will, and this is probably the wrong phrase, but that a recession will help alleviate some of the labor shortages that we're currently facing, particularly if there seems to be full employment in most markets, most major labor markets anyway?
I find that a really difficult question, Connor, because in traditional, from a traditional perspective, you would be absolutely right. When we are headed for a recession, people get fired or companies fail, and we see less vacancies and unemployment goes up. However, this time, we're also dealing with a skill shortage. And even though we are at full capacity, I think when we head into a recession, it's very likely that we're on one hand, we might see people losing their jobs. There still will be a high number of vacancies that go unfulfilled simply because there aren't enough people with the right skill sets. That is what I think will happen.
I think your analysis will be correct there, Anita. Do you remember there was this phrase years ago around a jobless recession? Do you remember that? I'm not sure which year that was from. Was that from the late 90s, early 2000s, or maybe longer?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I'm wondering if this potential recession or this recession that is coming might be a jobless one, whereby there's very little job losses, but you know, interest rates go through the roof, there's less funding, there's less capital available. Who knows? I suppose no one can predict the future, but we'll give it a go, Anita.
Yeah, although, Connor, the less capital available at the moment, there are so many investors looking to find a target for the funds that they have already raised that I don't think it's a shortage of capital. It is probably more that they have become more prudent in choosing their targets or finding companies that they think will be a good steward of the money.
Makes sense. So it's more to the traditional, you know, solid unit economics, profitability, good revenue growth, but potentially not growth at all costs. And Anita, as we look to the future, as we often do on this show, are you optimistic in terms of the future work? Where do you see things going from when you were last on our show? Have you changed your view on the future work, or is it broadly consistent with what we discussed the last time we were here?
So my view on the future of work hasn't changed as it pertains to this decade, right? For most modern economies, there will be issues because of demographics, skills, and a lack of automation. That hasn't changed. What I do think is that we have come to a point where over the past 2 or 3 years, CHROs have invested in all kinds of HR tech, from talent to acquisition, benefits, compensation, payroll, employee engagement, experience, you name it, it was there. And as we are headed into a period where there is probably more scrutiny on value for money, I will be very interested to see which solutions will be renewed. Which solutions do companies really think are worthwhile having, are taking the workforce forward, are helping them keep people happy? And what solutions turn out to be a little bit fluffy? So when you have some extra money, perfectly nice to spend on those solutions. But when you tighten the purse strings, do we still engage with them? Do we still contract them? I think over the next 1 or 2 years, we will start to see that shift. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you, Anita. I think it's a very exciting and interesting time ahead, Anita. And Anita, I have to say, I love having you on the show because I thoroughly enjoy our conversations. You really come at future work, future payroll from a really different and thoughtful angle. And you really take the data apart in a way that few others do. So I really appreciate your time, Anita, and I want to congratulate you on the book. So as we say in Ireland and the UK, fair play to you. I'm sure it wasn't an easy undertaking, despite your expertise in this space. So, and Anita, where is the best place should our audience wish to purchase your book? How can they find your book and how can they buy it?
They can find it on Amazon. And just search for my name, Anita Letting, or search for the title, How to Select Your Next Payroll, and it will come up.
Great. Well, Anita, thanks as always for your time. Really enjoyed our conversation. Really enjoyed your insights. You always bring something new, interesting, and different to the table. And wish you every success in terms of your book and its prominence. So, Anita, have a great day ahead. Really great to connect. Thank you.
Thanks, Connor. You too.